May I speak to you in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Please be seated. I think I'm on now. That's a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing. We'll see. So I decided this year, because Sunday falls on October 31st, that we would do something we don't normally do in the Anglican Church, which is to overtly reference and celebrate and memorialize Reformation Day. So on this day, in the year 1517, the Western world changed irrevocably. On this day, that year, an Augustinian monk, professor of the scriptures, a person who had in the past years experienced deep personal anguish and depression, who often thought of himself as doomed to hell, nailed, or at least purgatory, nailed a parchment to the heavy wooden castle church door in the German town of Wittenberg. And thus was set into slow motion, if you will, the death of medieval Europe and the emergence of the modern world. What the man Martin Luther nailed to that door were 95 theses, points for dispute, discussion. Points like, and here I'm just picking out two of the biggest ones, the main ones, and paraphrasing them a little bit. The Bible should be the central authority of the church, not the Pope or tradition. And the second one, people are saved by faith, not by any particular good works that they perform. Now these were not, they sound as if they are, but they were not abstract points of theology or doctrine, certainly not to Luther. They were nothing less than the royal road to flee the terror and dread he had lived under, straight into the house of a gracious God. The evidence is sparse, but there's enough to show us. Evidence like the delightful Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, that the average medieval person did not live with the same degree of Luther's existential dread. Now, our second song today was taken, the lyrics were put to Ein fester Berg, which is the famous Reformation tune, and you can pick up Luther's melancholy in that tune, can't you? Just some of it. That's why it's always been a favorite of Scandinavian heavy metal Christian groups. Right, Nathan? My buddy, he knows. He used to play that. Did you not? Yeah. Thank you, David, for riffing on the organ there at the end, because that needed to be like either heavy metal or an organ. At the same time, in the words of Oxford historian of Christianity, Diarmaid McCulloch, the church had become a death industry. Sounds awful. Masses were said for the dead in order to lessen their time in the fires of purgatory. And indulgences, those are like get out of jail free cards you could buy in order to lessen the time a relative spent in purgatory. And the church often preached to her financial advantage that the balance of the good deeds in your life were probably not going to be enough to outweigh the balance of sins committed in your life. Therefore, buy those indulgences and buy a lot of them. And this was reinforced by the image of Christ that predominated in that age, the awesome, fearsome Son of Man. The great judge who would separate the wheat from the chaff at the judgment of souls. And so fear was underlying things. It was, if you will, the rot that threatened the disease, if you will, of the age. And if Christianity were to survive, to somehow match with the psyche of the average person and the emerging hopefulness of the Renaissance, this sense that we have a world to enjoy as well as to endure, if we're going to learn how to live from hope towards joy, and if we're going to own the truth that the fuel of daily living has to be more about love than fear, then the church had to change. It had to reform. And most everyone knew it. It was kind of the open secret of the age. Luther just happened to call the question, if you will. Now, we Anglicans, we participated in all of the Reformation age in a bit of a unique way. There were people who were meeting at the White Horse pub in London planning reform of theology. And they wanted to influence King Henry, but King Henry was reticent. So they played to his fear of no male heir, so that when Henry broke from Rome, he was still Catholic in his heart, if you will. When he died, he asked for masses to be said for his soul in his will. And so he broke from Rome to become the supreme head of the church in England, not so much for reasons of doctrine as it was for reasons of politics. This trend then continued in the 1530s, when the monasteries were shut down, not so much again for reasons of theology as the greed of Thomas Cromwell's officials who wanted to become landed gentry. So I'm taking a little different tack on Thomas Cromwell there than Hilary Mantel would, more in line with Diarmaid MacCulloch. In England and in all Europe, reform then was undertaken, not in the spirit of Luther's 95 Theses, open discussion and dispute, in which, you know, we'd all come to our senses and understand what needed to happen, but rather under the cover of a fear as deep and as damaging as the fear of purgatory's fire. Those who called themselves reformers were often as likely to burn heretics as the medieval church. Now, it was only slowly and gradually that the true spirit of reform was able to come alive in the Anglican Church, leading to a unique level of dissent within England. A level of dissent that was so severe that, first of all, it led to civil war. So that's not a good thing. But was later, in the wake of that civil war, more open, to include diverse ways of thinking and believing, including Catholic ways and Puritan ways and everything in between. In particular, the emphasis of the Anglicans came to be not one common way of thinking about God, Christ, or the Christian life, but common praying, coming together in the presence of God using agreed upon language to submit our lives to the divine mystery, asking for grace and mercy together in common in whatever state or condition we stumbled into the pews. So Anglicans think of themselves as Reformed Catholics, generally. We've held on to far more of the great tradition than most Reformation churches, things like cathedrals, bishops, priests, and the centrality of the Holy Eucharist, though many of the Reformation churches have now, in dialogue with Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, recovered that as well. But because of our connections to the great tradition, a kind of pride has developed within Anglicanism, And we don't like to think of ourselves as true Reformation, as a true Reformation church. Maybe because the Roman Catholic Church is the biggest and we want to be with the biggest. I'm not quite sure why, but actually we are a Reformation church. And we need to emphasize that, I think. Sometimes we don't. We do believe in reformed and always reforming. At our best, we believe in truth wherever we find it, in the great tradition, in the new learning of the present movement. And so we have kind of a dance, the Bible, tradition, reason, experience, all sitting around a table conversing or dancing, whatever metaphor you like to use. Truth refracted poetically through stained glass and sacraments. And so, you wonder why I've been waxing on about this. I dare say, in reference to our gospel reading, with differences noted, of course, this is similar to the vision of Jesus. When Jesus enters into the disputes, and he does all the time, so he's not against disputes, he does it with the religious leaders of the day from the impulse to reform. This has been one of the great gifts of modern scholarship. As Luther never imagined that he'd have to leave the Catholic Church, so Jesus probably never sought to start a new religion. And that sounds like a radical thing for many Christians. But rather sought a wide-scale and comprehensive reform of Judaism. A reform of Judaism that would look as much to the Abrahamic covenant as it would to the Mosaic covenant of law. You see, the promise, the original promise, remember Abraham and Sarah in Ur of the Chaldees, in Mesopotamia, was that if they would adventure with God and learn of God and follow God as sojourners. Think of lifelong learners, people who would develop a spirituality over the course of their entire lives by faith. Then, if they would do that, through them, all the families of the earth would be blessed, all the tribes, all the nations. And so, instead of being concerned with merely their own progeny, their own ethnic identity, the mission of Israel was to be as a light to the nations. The challenge before Jesus was how to start a reform, a movement of reform, in which the immediacy of God's promise to Abraham and Sarah came back into the front of people's eyes, without, at the same time, leaving all of the developments of Moses, of David, and the rest of the scriptures. More, even more difficult than that, of course, was how to bring reform to Israel when the nation's religious and political leaders were determined to undermine him at every point, at every turn, when they seemed determined to protect only their own interests. We have to think carefully about each exchange and not paint too broad a brush with too broad a brush. He's not naive then about the motives behind most questions when they're asked of him. He knows that much of the time it's if it's a religious leader or a scribe that's questioning him, the motive is trap, entrapment. Maybe discredit, maybe even to arrest and to kill. He's just been dealing with the Sadducees. These are the group that's mostly in charge of the temple. They're the powerful ones. They're the ones who believe only in the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures as authentic, written by Moses, they believe. And they don't find any doctrine of resurrection in those five books. They think it's a non-reality. And so they dispute with Jesus, and Jesus has shown them that they've been missing the living God that Abraham, Isaac, and Moses knew. And one of the scribes who's been listening in has been very impressed. It appears he's ready for a genuine dispute, if you will. A genuine interchange, maybe genuine reformation. And so he walks up to the meeting, as it were, and tacks up his thesis, his question. What's the greatest commandment? And Jesus answers, not so much with a particular one, but with Moses' great exhortation. When he's finished giving the nation of Israel the entire set of laws, which were to operate as their constitution in the book of Deuteronomy, he sums things up and he says, you know, this is about the oneness of God and our complete and total love for God. And he joins that with a line taken out of the book of Leviticus, which we don't often understand if we don't see it in its original context. Because in that context, Moses uses it. This line, of course, is love your neighbor as yourself. He writes that line kind of in the middle of nowhere, it seems, and then you read the context and it's about the risky move of speaking up for someone who is on trial for his life. And if you know something that would exonerate this person, you can't keep silent. You have to step forward and do something. You have to speak the truth. Or the deep courage required to lay the desire to hate aside when someone has done something awful to you. This is the context within which we get this phrase. And the one who's listening to Jesus, who's asked, who's tacked his dispute question up on the board, he mirrors back to Jesus in agreement. By the way, this is a great device to use in your marriages. If you're not sure what your partner has said to you, you mirror back just to get clear, to get clarity. Saves a lot of disputes, saves a lot of escalating disputes. But this man, perhaps you noticed this, he does this in a way that gets to the very heart of reform. He applies it to himself in a way that undermines his self-interest. He shows he's truly heard Jesus by speaking against the particular death industry that was at the heart of the power wielded by the teachers of the law and the scribes and the priests, the sacrificial system. To love God completely and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than to offer animals and other sacrifices to God. Just as the poor had suffered under the death industry of the medieval church, the need to purchase indulgences to pay for masses for the dead, so the poor of Jesus' day often, even though they were given options to offer less costly sacrifices than the richer people, they often still struggled to meet the demands of the sacrificial system because of having to leave work, having to travel, all of those kinds of things. And without honoring that sacrificial system, it was hard to believe that you could be on God's good side. And so they were constantly pressed. And so Jesus acknowledges this man's wisdom. This man is on the way to getting it. Because, you see, true reform opens the door to a gracious God for everyone. It lets go of institutional control and economic advantage. And so Mark notes that after this exchange, no one dared to ask Jesus any more questions. Why? Well, there's probably a lot of reasons, but I think that they recognized their own unwillingness to change, to face the music the way this scribe had. So we need to ask questions. It's not a good thing to not dare to ask questions. We need to ask questions, but true reform comes to us only if we have the willingness to hear the truth of the answers to the questions we ask. So what was needed in Jesus' day was reform of the sacrificial system itself. What was needed in the Reformation was a different kind of reform to the sacrificial system. To do so, it was necessary to recover the centrality of the promise to Abraham and Sarah, which in Luther's time was put as the good news of God's gracious forgiveness, accessed by faith. And we, of course, need to ask questions around what needs to be reformed today. That's the question that is begged by a sermon like this. What is proving itself to be the disease of our age, especially in the church? Now, I'm sure, we've heard, you know, we're the beginning of COP26. There's all kinds of issues around racism and about equitable redistribution or distribution of goods in our land and in our politics. And there's no end of issues that need reform. I'm sure we could all offer opinions because, and maybe this gets at the heart of it, because that's what we do. We are individualists. We curate our own truth from whatever sources we feel suits us. Like those who did not dare ask Jesus any more questions, one of the diseases of our age is to put ourselves in these silos that help us actually avoid those questions that might shake us in our view of the world. And we do that all along the political continuum, all along the religious continuum. We do it almost every day. But what it means to be a disciple, to be like this questioner, is to embrace the way of Christ, of course, which is the way of love, the way of radical love that is willing to have our own privileged positions questioned. This vision is shalom, peace. It is to see our individuality, which is very important, in light of the wider community. If we try to curate the truth, if we try just to curate our lives on our own, create our lives on our own, we miss the love that is at the center of everything. And so this Sunday, I challenge us to tack our most central questions to Christ. And will we then, in turn, allow Christ to speak to us, to impress on our hearts the truth of change required? Now, we may be afraid, like those who dared not ask him any more questions. We may be afraid that the call to a total love is too daunting, too difficult. But actually, it's every other approach, a holding back of love, a holding back of our lives that leads to fear, division, personal anguish, and disappointment. It is the word love that explains the commitment of Ruth to Naomi, leaving all that she had known. It explains this dawning commitment of the man in our text. Our possibility of reform is born of the love that was willing to go all the way, to leave the home country, if you will, and go to the cross, to put an end to all of the sacrificial systems and our dead works, as Hebrews puts it. So that Ruth, so that this man, so that you and I can now, in freedom and in a spirit of adventure, sojourn with God all our days. I pray for that kind of reform in the Anglican Church, in our lives. Amen.